Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, June 26th, 1998. In the fireside room this morning is Frank Rogers. Today's session number is 98-8 and is titled Spirituality and Story, Seeking the Kingdom of God. Let's listen in.
We could maybe close the doors on our way in would be really helpful. I am Frank Rogers, and this is the third in a series on spirituality and story. I am particularly jazzed for today's session because I asked Ray McKeever if he would be willing to share some music with us today. One of my dreams has been to tell stories and sing songs together. I think it's a peculiarly meaningful and powerful combination to have story and song. And so essentially, what we kind of extemporaneously came up with this morning was to offer a concert of stories and songs that kind of let the stories and songs speak for themselves. And so I'm going to keep to a real minimum the commentary and the theologizing and all of that. So if you're all are up for a little concert this morning, we'll see how it goes. I've never done this before. I'm so delighted that Ray was willing to do this at the last minute at my urging. So thanks, Ray.
You're welcome. Thank you for asking.
The theme for today is a dimension of spirituality that I call seeking to actively participate in the coming of the kingdom of God. And the heartbeat behind that, the impulse, is that part of spirituality, part of what it means to live in the Spirit, is to participate with God's Spirit that yearns for healing, yearns for reconciliation, yearns for justice in the midst of our broken world. And that is as much a part of spirituality as prayer and inward contemplation and cultivating the inner journey. Often people talk about spirituality and social justice, but it occurs to me that that is as inappropriate as talking about the Old Testament and the Bible. Right? The Old Testament is part of the Bible. Social justice and compassion and liberation is part of spirituality. And the reason we say that is for twofold. One is that the Spirit in which we live to participate, in which we seek to participate, that Spirit is as much concerned about the transformation of the world and social justice and compassion as that Spirit is interested in our own inward healing, equally in both of those. But also, when we've talked about spirituality, we've talked about that longing within the human spirit that reaches out for the fullness of life. And I think that deep within that human spirit, one of those longings is the longing for hope, the longing for connection, the longing for healing in the midst of the brokenness of the world that we have all tasted and is part and woven into all of our communities. Part of the longing of the Spirit is to find resources that access that own longing and enable us to participate in the journey towards healing and justice with meaning. And so what we offer today are some stories and some songs that we're going to pretty much let speak for themselves, but that may illuminate or reveal threads within that particular journey of what does it mean to participate with that Spirit, to access our own spirits longing for healing and justice in the midst of this broken creation. Does that sound like a framing of a theme? Okay, so how about a story? When I was in high school, I was as interested in social justice about as much as I was interested in volunteering for extra homework, you know? something that I was willing to do as part of the community, but certainly it's just something that you have to get done and endure. It was not something that necessarily engaged my passions. But I had a youth minister for whom social justice was a life commitment. He had been raised in Mexico, the son of missionary parents, and he had been in the midst of some of the most wretched poverty that you could imagine, and that touched his soul in a very deep way, and his passion for justice and healing permeated everything that he did. one of the things that he did with our youth group was every summer he would plan with Catholic Relief Services a mission service project into Mexico, where we would spend 1 or 2 weeks as a youth group participating in a very poor community, doing anything from teaching Bible study and painting a parsonage to teaching sanitation skills or teaching reading to some of the children. 2 weeks really living with these folks. Well, when I was in high school, I went on one of these mission trips. And along with the rest of the youth group, there was another young lady who joined us. Her name was Stephanie. Now, Stephanie was not exactly like the rest of us. Stephanie lived in Hillsboro, in the Bay Area. Do you know Hillsboro? She lived just down the block from the Hearst Mansion. And us, the rest of us, sort of the children of working class parents, I mean, we never exactly connected with Stephanie. I mean, Stephanie got a brand new Mustang for her 16th birthday. She always wore designer clothes. She hung out with the kids that we thought their noses were a little too high in the air at school. And she was part of our youth group, and Stephanie was joining us on this trip. Now, I have to say, Stephanie did not want to be on this trip for anything. The only reason she was going was that her parents were going to Europe on a vacation, and they thought that it would be good for her to have this experience. Well, she came, but if she was going to come to Mexico and live amongst the poor, she was going to at least do it in style. She brought her designer luggage, Gucci bags, absolutely stuffed with her designer clothes. She had an electric hairdryer, all of her makeup. She had a reading lamp, several pieces of literature to read at night. She had chocolate, Godiva chocolate. She had macadamia nuts. She was fully stocked. I mean, she was going to go and live with the poor, but she wasn't going to suffer while she was doing it, right? Well, we all got on the bus and we made our way down to Cancun, Mexico. And in Cancun is one of the most wretched barrios that you could imagine. I still can't believe that people live in the situations they do. Corrugated tin shacks, cardboard houses, littering these vacant fields, people drinking out of muddy water that just comes down with plants dumping sewage into it. Absolutely wretched kind of poverty. And we spent the days there doing the various kinds of things that I described. And Stephanie, she participated in all of those things as well, but she also didn't want to get too involved. And so every chance that she could, she just kind of disengaged herself and sit underneath the tree and read one of her novels or go for a walk or go eat chocolate someplace, but she kind of kept to herself. Anybody been to Cancun, Mexico, you'd know that Cancun is not just a barrio, right? Cancun also is one of the poshest resort areas in the world. People coming from all over to enjoy immaculate, beautiful beaches, 5-star hotels, restaurants with food you cannot imagine. And you might even say that in Cancun, you had essentially a 2-tiered city. You had the posh resort area sitting side by side with this incredible barrio that stretched off into the horizon. And in that 2-tiered city, there was a deep hostility. The people in the barrio resented all the people who lived in the posh area because none of the money ever made its way into the barrio. And the people who lived in the posh area of town, they resented the presence of the poor in the barrios because their very presence was going to antagonize the people who came to visit and that they lived off of. And every once in a while, people from the barrio, they would walk the streets and they would beg or they would bargain for trinkets or they would panhandle, maybe they would even pickpocket. And the people who lived off of all of those tourists knew that if they were harassed and hassled, they're not going to come, right? So what emerged was a turf war. A turf war in which everybody was to keep to themselves on their own side, as severe as any gang neighborhood in East LA. And every once in a while, to maintain those barriers, the people who lived in the rich area, some of the young kids, would make an indiscriminate raid into the barrio and just beat up somebody to let it be known that you stay in your side of the town. One of those indiscriminate raids happened while we were in Cancun. And it occurred when Stephanie was off taking a walk by herself. And as she described it, she was walking down a dusty dirt road, minding her own business, when out from a corrugated tin shack off to her right, shot out a boy of about 6 or 7, wearing threadbare cutoffs and barefoot, running like a jackrabbit across that dirt road and off into a vacant field to her left. And just behind him emerged this pack of adolescent kids, long pants and shoes, a badge of their social standing. And she watched as this pack of kids chased down this young boy in the middle of that field, and once they captured him, began to beat that kid senseless. The way Stephanie described it, it was like something inside of her just broke. In spite of herself, she found herself running, screaming, "Enough! Enough!" She ran up to the pack. She tried to pull them off of the young boy. They just threw this gringo lady onto the ground. So she got on her hands and knees and wormed her way in between their legs until she could embrace the young boy in her arms, and the others were beating on her back instead of on the kid. And finally, panting, they stopped and they looked at her like, "What are you doing here?" And they turned and they fled back to the skyscrapers, leaving Stephanie to tend for this whimpering, bruised young boy. I will never forget the day we left Cancun. We were all on the school bus. We were tired, eager to get back to reruns on TV and McDonald's hamburgers. We had done our time here. Everybody on that bus except for Stephanie. Stephanie was outside near the door. And she was with Dave, our youth minister. And with tears streaming down her face, she was pleading with him, "Please, can't we stay just a few more days? There's just too much pain here." Stephanie makes her home now in Chula Vista, California, just south of San Diego, where she's an immigration rights attorney. She looks back to that trip as her turning point.
Take, oh, take me as I am. Summon out what I shall be. Set your seal upon my heart and live in me. Take, oh, take me as I am. Summon out what I shall be.
Take, oh,
When I lived in New Jersey, going to graduate school, I befriended a young mother. Her name was Carol Bamsberger. She had two elementary children, and who were in school. And the way that I came about meeting her had to do with those two children. It was in the early 1980s, and she was just to drop them off at school, and had gone with a couple of other mothers to a Denny's for coffee later that morning, when one of the mothers told her that the school had just admitted a child who was living with the AIDS virus. And this young mother, she was all 4'10", but as feisty as a bulldog, found herself standing up in the middle of that Denny's and shouting at those mothers, "Come on, let's get our kids out of that school right now. I'm not going to let them find out on my child that you can get AIDS from a pencil eraser." And she marched to the school, and she got the kids out of school. And she began a one-woman crusade against that school board to reverse the policy of letting these children into the schools. Well, she began to do her research on this particular thing, and she read all kinds of evidence to suggest that you really can't get AIDS from a pencil eraser, but she was not going to be deterred. She was on a mission. And you have to know Carol. She was feisty. One evening, she was in a grocery store, and as she's walking up one of the aisles, hanging on to the grocery cart, something came over her that had never come over her before in her life. She found her body starting to tremble. And she began to lose complete control of her body to the point where she found herself falling onto the floor and she was having some kind of a seizure. Literally, her muscles were twitching back and forth and she could not control anything. She couldn't even control her mouth to cry out for help. But she was fully conscious. Her mind was completely there, but her body was completely in the throes of these spasms. And as she's looking around, panicking, wanting somebody to come and help her, she could see all of the other grocery shoppers looking at her and quickly turning their head and walking the other way. And she's thinking in her mind, "Please don't walk away, come and help me." But everybody is just disappearing on her. And then, right in the middle of the aisle of the grocery store, Jesus was standing there. And she looked right into the face of Jesus. And Jesus said to her, "Carol, do you see all those people that are abandoning you? Why are you abandoning my people? I want you to care for them." And he disappeared. Carol formed the first statewide interfaith AIDS organization in the country. Back in 1982, I think it was. And since then, it's become a national spokesperson working in education for AIDS and in ministry. This woman is an absolute powerhouse. And it's because Jesus visited her in the midst of that grocery store. But you know, she had a transformation, but the rest of her family was a little bit slower in coming. I mean, think of her children. Yanked out of school one day, and now your mother's starting this organization. She was trying to recruit the priest to help her out, and now she's going to the priest and asking for space to be donated so that she would have a little office. And the priest is saying, "Absolutely no way." So she begins to start strategically planning some episodes. And it turned out that there was this one young man, absolutely emaciated, who was not able to live in his apartment anymore and had to be moved to another place. Who was she going to get to help? She went up to the priest and said, "Look, I know that you cannot offer us any space in the church, but would you just help me out for 20 minutes? I need you to help me get somebody into the car." And as this priest was holding a grown man weighing 85 pounds, carrying him down into the car, he found his own heart melting away to the point where there was abundant space for Carol and her little organization that was budding. One day, she had to go visit somebody in the hospital. And her daughter was with her, and she asked her young daughter, 7 years old, if she would like to join her going to the hospital. She said, "Mommy, I would, but I have to say I'm really scared." She said, "That's okay. I'm scared too. It is a scary thing. But you know what I do? I stop before I go into the room every time I meet one of these people, and I say a little prayer. Would you pray with me?" And they stopped in the hallway, outside the door, and Carol whispered the prayer, "Jesus, help me to see your face on the face of those who suffer." They walked into the door, and there was this man, lesions covering his body, tubes going into his nose and his veins, bones coming out of his emaciated skin, absolutely on death's doorstep. And this young girl walks in, and as soon as she sees him, she rushes over, grabs his hand, and says, "Jesus, you look like you are in such pain. Don't worry, I will stay with you now."
Together number 476 in the end.
I had a friend. I'd like to call him Ishmael, because like the Melville character in that book, he's so loved. He spent torturous hours out on the wilderness of Ahab's seas, and also like the bastard child of Abraham and Hagar, he too was a wanderer. But his name wasn't Ishmael, his name was Marty. And I met Marty when we were both college students at a party. I should say I met Marty and his guitar, because Marty's guitar was an ever-present companion with him for just about as long as I knew him. At the party, he was sitting off in a corner by himself, and he was a pre-med student, and he was trying to memorize polysyllabically anatomical Latin terms to the tunes of James Taylor songs. And so to the chorus of Country Road and Sunny Skies, he was sitting there, tibia major laborum, tibia major laborum. That was a real characteristic posture for Marty. He loved to be with people, but he felt a little uncomfortable being too close. And so he would usually be sitting off to the side, strumming these mournful melodies as they would reverberate throughout the party. And they usually were haunting songs. He loved to sing about that love that was lost, or that home that was very difficult to find, or the road that continued to wander looking for a place to rest. James Taylor was one of his favorite musicians. And usually we would sit at the party playing cards and watching sports or philosophizing about deep issues, and Marty would just sit there playing his songs, until he would flash a knowing grin and join the rest of us and spectate on sports for a while. But mostly, I remember him sitting cross-legged in a room, on a bus, at a park, on the steps, anywhere, everywhere, strumming his songs on the guitar he cradled, letting those mournful melodies mingle throughout the air. And he had something to mourn. Marty was born in a dilapidated trailer park out in the dusty plains of Oklahoma. He was the son of alcoholic parents. When he was one, a neighbor found him screaming and soiled in his crib while his parents were out someplace on one of their frequent binges. When he was three, a traveling car got him down off of the roof of their trailer home, a forgotten ladder leaning up against the side, his parents laying wasted in the living room. When he was four, he was brought to a hospital with lacerations on his body conspicuously shaped like beer bottle caps. When he was six, he set a small fire in the kitchen trying to cook for himself, his parents not having been seen in 2 days. And that's when he began to become part of the foster parent program. And for 7 years, he wandered in and out of various homes until at 13, he became the actual guardian of a single family for the rest of his high school experience. Marty was a creature who was eager to please. He strained to be easygoing and loved to kind of hang out. An absolutely wonderful guy. He worked his way through high school, got enough good grades to be able to go to a small college in Indiana, and there he began to find a major. He started out trying to become a writer, but he just couldn't unlock the melodies inside of him. So then he decided to become a lawyer. He even clerked in the town's public defender office for a while, but he just wasn't at home in the legal system. And so then he became a pre-med major, and that launched the anatomical phase of his musical life. But that too did not hold him, and so he finally graduated with a rather unmarketable degree in psychology. And for several years, he ambled in and out of a number of jobs. He worked at the Y in Indiana. He was a camp counselor in Massachusetts. I got a Christmas card once. He was selling insurance in Florida. Until finally, in his mid-20s, he received his call. He'd always been a Christian, but now he felt like the ministry was the place for him. He came out to Princeton joined me with my old MDiv program and studied to become a minister and became a youth minister in a nearby parish for a couple of years. The youth loved him. The people cared for him a great deal too, as he preached sermons and take youth on outings and administered the congregation's life. But you know, even after working in the parish and being so excited about it, it just still was not home for him. And so in his late 20s, he found himself wandering once more. And this time he settled for his last spell in Arizona. And Marty found the job for which he was perfectly suited. He became the director of a refugee program. Refugees roaming into the country, not having a house, needing someone to help get them oriented into the culture. They needed someone to help them do that, and Marty was perfect. He was a survivor. He could help them find homes. He could help them get medical care. He could help get them into churches. He became an activist for this, became speaking in churches, in civic organizations. He would campaign for legislation in the midst of Phoenix. He found the thing that absolutely gave him life and joy. Helping these homeless persons, he found himself a home in a work that gave him meaning. And then, in the early 90s, I received his call. I was in Southern California, and he asked if he could come and stay with me for a couple of days. And he came, but this time he did not bring his guitar. I hadn't seen him for a little over a year, but I still was not ready for the news he was going to share with me. One of those tenacious viruses of our world had attached itself in his body, and Marty was dying. He was just a shadow of the person that I had known just a few months before. And here he was in my midst and asking some hard questions. Frank, why? Why is life so hard? Why is it so difficult to find some meaning? Why, when you finally think you've got something that makes you feel that there's a reason for you to be alive, bringing something of hope into this world, why just then is the whole thing just snatched away from you? Why? Why indeed? While he was there, we took a walk out to the beach. It was a beautiful, sunny, coastal sky day. Children were playing, whirring on Ferris wheels and riding on their rollerblades. Lovers were strolling on the path. The waves were coming in and out onto the sand. A beautiful California day. But to us, it was like a shadow was cast over the whole thing, as if this was the very life and joy that was escaping Marty's grasp. We sat on a bench, and after some time, Marty shared something with me that still lives inside. He said, "Do you know what really hurts? What really hurts is to know that you are going to die and you still haven't reached what it is you're looking for." And I said, "Marty, what is that? What is it you have so sought that has eluded your grasp?" And he thought for a long time, as if in his mind's eye he was traveling all the different roads that he had meandered along. And finally it eased back into his own mouth. And he spread his arms and he said, "What I've always wanted, I just want to know. I want to know this. And he reached out to embrace all of these kids and the laughter and the sunshine. He said, I want to know this. I want to know the God in this. I want to know God so deeply that I could sing it. I can sing the pain. I know that well. And I've sung that all of my life. But what I really yearn for, I want to be able to sing the peace, to know the God in the peace, to know that God so deep in my belly that it just comes out in song and I know that I am home. That was the last time I saw Marty. 5 months later, his wandering came to an end on a gurney in a county hospital at age 34. And I remember the night that I went out to his gravestone. It was a warm September Phoenix evening. And I sat there on the clumps, clods of grass, that concrete slab with his name on it. And as I sat in the silence, it was like tunes that I could not get out of my head. The memories just started to swelter through me. The time that we watched the sunrise on the Allegheny Mountains perched on our bicycles. The time that we schemed to buy the Davis Mansion out of the point of Penobscot Bay when it was up for sale. Doing the wave to all the drivers on North Haven out in the island of off the coast of Maine. The time we greeted honeymooner couples at an airport with picnic supplies for their own honeymoon and the joy as they walked away. And these tunes just reverberated around me. But even after they passed, I was left in the silence. And then it occurred to me, you know what would have been perfect? I wish Marty was buried with his guitar. I mean, that would have been the way for him to go. I mean, I could just see him saying with James Taylor in James Taylor's own song, if the guitar can't go to heaven, Lord, I don't want to go either. He should have had it with him in there, but he didn't. And maybe that was like Marty too. That music that would bring him home just out of his reach. But still, as I sat there, my ears, they strained to hear some echo, some note to sustain my hope. I longed to know that Marty was home. And even now, I hope that Marty is singing.
Time in this song where I'd like you to do some rhythm with me. Just little rhythm. Like a pencil on the back of the chair or a handful of loose change. So if you can find that before we get going, that would be great. But before you start doing that, I want to teach you the words of this song. It goes like this. Somewhere in the universe, there is a song all of us know. Somewhere in the universe, a song of love with words of hope. somewhere in the universe there is a song all of us know. Somewhere in the universe, a song of love with words of hope. It's a song for the poor young woman. It's a song for the rich old man. For the black and the white and the people in between. And we will sing it whenever we can. We will sing it.
We will sing it whenever we can.
One more time.
We will sing it whenever we can.
Somewhere.
Somewhere in the universe there is a song. All of us know somewhere in the universe a song of love with words of hope.
So come and gather near, all you who live in fear. The song is not so far away. You know the song could be right here. Can we get the rhythm going? On the second verse, keep the rhythm going.
Somewhere in the universe there is a place, a sacred ground. Somewhere in the universe, a place where truth can still be found. It's a place for the poor young woman. It's a place for
an old folk tale from Thailand. It appears that there was this large plantation owner who had many slaves and people who worked for him, and he was not the kindest of men. And one night as he was sleeping, there was this noise that seemed to come from the jungle. But once it started to come, it would pulsate through the earth, and it'd come into his house, and it just kept himself awake. And the noise was very simple. Oh, 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 oh. But as that noise continued to come, it just drove him crazy. He couldn't sleep. He would put his head under the covers, pillows over his head, cotton in his ears, but he could not get that sound out of his mind. Oh. So he got some of his workers and he ordered them, Go out and drive that voice out of here. I do not want to hear it ever again. And so his workers, they took all of their weapons and they drove that voice all the way to the far edge of the land. And they came back and they reported to him, the voice is gone. And that night, as he got into his bed, oh, 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 it was driving the man crazy. He was an expert hunter himself, and so he determined that he would go and silence the voice forever. He grabbed his bows, his arrows, and he marched into the jungle. He followed the source all the way to a tree, and there up at the top of the tree was a bird. And that bird was leaning back, and out of its belly was coming, oh. So he got an arrow, and he took aim, and he shot that bird straight through the heart. The bird came sailing out of the tree and landed straight on the ground in front of him. Oh, 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 oh. He grabbed a bag and put the bird into the bag and began to pound it against a tree, took a large axe and started hitting that until it could just chop it up into millions and billions of pieces, and still, he dug out a huge hole 6 feet deep, took that bag and all the pieces of that bird, shoved it down into the hole, buried it back up, put rocks on top of it, and out of the ground. He dug it back up, wrapped it around in rope, tied knots all around it, and then tied a huge boulder onto that sack, went out into the deepest part of the river, and threw the whole bag and rock into that river until it sank all the way down to the bottom of that river, and finally, silence. He gathered his weapons and his tools, and he marched back to his plantation. But the water worked on those ropes. And water is a powerful force. It makes canyons. It melts rocks. And that water twisted the fibers of that rope until it began to come loose. And that bird's body and that sack floated up to the top of the river and floated down the river towards the sandy beach near this man's plantation. And as he's going to sleep that night, exasperated. He comes out of his room in his night clothes. He marches over to that beach. He takes that burlap sack and he opens it up. And there in the midst of that sack are thousands of little of those birds, each one of them. Oh, oh, oh. And then the man sits down and nods. I understand now. You are the freedom bird, and your song can never be killed.
My life flows on in endless song above earth's lamentation. I hear the real, though far off hymn that I'm singing.
that movement.
State of freedom.
Experiment, and I've never done this before. I don't know how you get off the stage. One of those hooks to pull us back. But those are the stories and the songs that we felt led to share with each other, and so here we are. If anything is bubbling up in anyone, feel free to share a word. Or
I think the stories and the songs together sort of multiply it, the feelings and the response, great combination.
I think maybe we should have a forum where everybody tells stories.
Because it accesses your own stories. As you hear the stories and sing the songs, stories are inside of you that start bubbling up. Yeah, that's one of the gifts of story. It's one of the gifts. I like the freedom bird.
For some of us that are intellectually challenged, I think this is a great meeting.
Yeah, I think it was interesting that I came in a bit late and I just heard the beginning of the song that was written on the board there. And I was thinking how this place, I just came yesterday, but I feel that it's starting to engage my heart. And so often we live in our heads around in the world outside. And suddenly the whole thing, the songs and the stories you told today really started to open up my heart. And you have a great gift of, every time you told a story, I said, I'm not going to cry this time. The only time I didn't cry was the Freedom Bird story. But it was like, oh, fly in the eye time. That's a wonderful gift. Thank you for sharing it.
I was just going to make a quip that I'd love to have Ray write some songs for my stories. But then I think the last couple of years, just for fun, I've tried to write, sometimes that's one of my favorite chants as well, try to accompany certain parts of my own story with songs I either hear or make up. And when that part of my life story comes to mind, a tune can sometimes come with it. So to hear you guys do work together is wonderful, because I think it's a tool that I've found, it's a tool that I've found very useful in my own life. Although I still like you to have to sing a song to one of my life stories. So sometime we'll have to do that, but not with 100 people listening.
But isn't that great? You know, and of course he didn't write these for these stories.
Right.
They just were perfect blendings. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Different songs spark different stories, and stories spark songs. And yeah. I'm sorry. I thought you were gonna go. Well, One last vignette. It's not a story. It's not a story. Martin Buber, the Jewish philosopher, tells this about his grandfather. And his grandfather was a disciple of the famous Baal Shem Tov, a Jewish master mystic. And apparently, when Buber's grandfather was old and his legs were failing him, and he was confined to sitting and lying down, he was unable to walk. He was with the family members, and one of them said, "Grandfather, share with us again the stories that the Rabbi Baal Shem Tov shared with you." And the grandfather just started to get into the stories, and as he was remembering them, he said, "Well, you've got to see him tell the stories." And the way he did is he would get up and he would dance around, and as he was telling the stories of the Rabbi Baal Shem Tov, the grandfather himself was out of his chair, dancing around, embodying the story, and by the time he was done, his legs were healed. And Buber said, "That's the way all stories should be told."